Seven Dynasty and becoming the sole owner of the Pebble Project, we'll reevaluate all of the programs going forward.
Anglo-American pulls out of the Pebble Mine Partnership. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, examining student preparedness in public and private schools.
There's both a merit in looking at the numbers in that manner, but there's also a little bit of a danger.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The giant mining company Anglo American has pulled its support for the proposed Pebble Mine, but the other company in the partnership pledges to continue moving the project toward permitting and development. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Monday morning, Anglo American announced that it would no longer be involved in the Pebble Mine project and would take a loss of $300 million. That means that Northern Dynasty Minerals takes over sole ownership of the Pebble Limited Partnership and the state mining claims that make up the Pebble deposit. Earlier this year, the partnership announced that they hope to release the mine plan later this year, with the goal of entering into permitting late this year or early next year. Sean McGee is Vice President of Public Affairs for Northern Dynasty Minerals.
And at this point, there's no change, no decisions have been taken to change the plans. That being said, Northern Dynasty, in becoming the sole owner of the Pebble Project, will reevaluate all of the programs going forward. And so at this point, we're not announcing any changes to our plans, but certainly there will be a review and analysis before we announce exactly how the project will move forward and on what timeline.
Back in 2007, Anglo American and Northern Dynasty Minerals created the Pebble Limited Partnership. As part of the deal, Anglo American agreed to a staged investment of about $1.4 billion. Monday's statement from Anglo American noted that the details of the withdrawal from the partnership are being developed and implemented. However, Anglo American expects to record a charge of $300 million at the end of the year. That's an important fact, according to Joel Reynolds. He's a senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is an environmental organization that is part of the large coalition of entities opposed to development of the Pebble Mine.
It wasn't just that Anglo American withdrew from the project today. It was that they decided to write down their investment. What that means to me is that they didn't have a buyer, and that the fundamental problem now for this project is there is no major player to provide the funding, very significant funding, that would be essential if this project were to move forward. That, I think, is a really important aspect of what Anglo American did today.
Anglo American's decision to withdraw from the Pebble Mine project is drawing praise from many stakeholders in the Bristol Bay region, including some of the company's most vocal critics. Robin Samuelson sits on the board of directors for the Bristol Bay Native Corporation and the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. He also sits on the Chogyang Tribal Council based in Dillingham. Samuelson stresses that the campaign will continue to get permanent protections implemented against large-scale mining in the Bristol Bay region.
We will keep our pressure on until the day we get it.
In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The financial markets reacted to the news that Anglo American had left the Pebble Partnership by driving the price of the sole remaining partner's stock to an all-time low. At the close of trading today, Northern Dynasty Minerals was selling for about $1.50 a share. A year ago, it was at $5. At the close of trading last week, it was at $2.22. On an average day, about 173,000 shares of Northern Dynasty are traded. Today, it was 4 million. Northern Dynasty is owned by the Vancouver mining firm Hunter Dickinson Incorporated, which has a number of mineral projects around the world. A high school diploma is supposed to be a sign of readiness for the next step, whether that's getting a job or going to college. But in Alaska, it turns out that most of the high school graduates who enter the state university system aren't ready for the work. the latest remediation numbers are getting attention from lawmakers seeking education reform, and those numbers are already shaping state policy. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
If you're a recent high school graduate attending the University of Alaska, odds are you're in the limbo known as developmental education. A full 52% of students are placed in classes that don't count towards their degrees and are simply meant to catch them up and cover material they should have mastered by the end of 12th grade. If these students were already prepared for undergraduate work, they would be in a much better spot.
They're going to typically take at least a year longer to complete their program. So the cost of their education is higher.
That's Dana Thomas. He's the University of Alaska's Vice President of Academic Affairs, and he recently did an analysis of the cost of developmental education. The financial burden isn't really on the university. About $2 million is spent getting those kids up to speed, and that's pretty much covered by tuition. Thomas says it's mostly hurting the students. On top of paying for extra coursework, they're losing a year's salary by not being in the workforce.
Between those two costs, that's a substantial amount of money.
By drilling down into the numbers from the past 5 years, Thomas found that students who were coming into the university system with their GEDs were the least prepared, with 60% of them needing some sort of developmental coursework. On the opposite end were privately homeschooled students. About a third of them had to do remedial work, but Thomas says that percentage is highly variable and based on only a small number of enrolled students. In the middle were public and private school kids. A little more than half of public school kids take developmental education courses, while a little less than half of private school students do. Thomas says that private schools come out ahead by just a few percentage points, but
they do a bit better. Some of that is simply size of operation, I'm sure, and individual personal contact, teacher to student.
Senator Mike Dunleavy has been holding hearings on the cost of education, and he requested the breakdown of which students needed remediation most. The Mat-Su area Republican says the public school numbers don't surprise him, but they are higher than he would like.
If you look at the rates, again, coming from the university and the Department of Education itself, feedback from businesses and blue-collar entities, we still have a ways to go.
Dunleavy is a former president of the Matanuska-Susitna School Board, and he worked as a school superintendent before being elected to the state senate last year. All the legislation he sponsored concerns education, with the most significant item being a constitutional amendment that would allow public money to go to private schools in the form of tax credits or vouchers. Dunleavy says that while he expects the debate over his amendment to continue next legislative session, he doesn't anticipate the remediation rates being used in that discussion, even though it's some of the only hard data that compares public school and private school outcomes in the state.
There's both a merit in looking at the numbers in that manner, but there's also a little bit of a danger.
Dunleavy adds that he doesn't think the numbers give a perfect comparison of public schools to private schools. They don't tell us anything about the students who go out of state for college or the more than half of Alaska graduates who put off college until later in life or don't go at all. On top of that, the public and private school numbers might be dealing with pretty different student populations.
In the 52% that need remediation coming out of the K-12 public schools, we may be including figures that have folks that, you know, have special needs. We don't know if that's the case with the private schools or the homeschools.
Whether or not these remediation rates factor into lawmakers' decisions over education funding next session, the numbers are already having an impact on the University of Alaska and the State Department of Education. Officials from both have been in talks about how the new state education standards can be tailored to bring those numbers down. The department has also recently moved to make college preparedness a larger part of its mission. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Some mental health workers in Fairbanks are losing their jobs. The financially troubled Fairbanks Community Behavioral Health Center is making the cuts after analysis of a $1.2 million debt and what it's going to take to keep operating. Interim Executive Director Jake Poole estimates the nonprofit agency will cut about half of its 50-some staff.
It's going to have to be a larger reduction of staff, and some of the services, primarily rehab services, will be adjusted. All of the therapeutic services, both adult and children, and emergency, will not be affected, but the rehab programs will be adjusted.
The agency is transitioning to management by Anchorage Community Mental Health during a two-day closure today and tomorrow. The Anchorage group has taken over a state grant for the Fairbanks facility and will run it at least until the next funding cycle in 2014. Poole says analysis of the budget has shown that failure to ensure client resources is part of what crippled finances.
You've got to make sure that the clients are being able to meet the fiscal responsibility, either through insurance or personally.
Poole says that's being addressed by new management. The Fairbanks agency is pursuing Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization in hopes of retaining some of its assets, including its primary facility on South Cushman Street. The agency is changing its name to Fairbanks Community Mental Health Service. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a university program to cultivate new Alaska Native leaders.
It serves our mission, and it's just a marvelous opportunity to be involved in this incredibly important part of Alaska's economy.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
A man in the village of Tanunak has been charged in the shooting death of his 2-year-old son. 24-year-old Edward Moses was arrested Friday for first-degree murder of Kyle Moses. He was arraigned Saturday and is being held on $500,000 bail. Alaska State Troopers first responded to the village early Friday morning after receiving a report that a child had died. They found Moses barricaded in his house and negotiated with him for hours until he surrendered. According to witnesses and court documents, Edward Moses shot his son Kyle late Thursday night. He later admitted to shooting to troopers and said he did it because he was upset with his wife, the boy's mother. Late Thursday night, Moses entered his wife's house and told everyone to leave the house except for his son, and told everyone to leave their cell phones behind. He allegedly racked the shotgun and pointed it at one person he thought wasn't moving fast enough. He later allegedly called someone on the phone asking for his wife and said he would kill his child in 15 minutes if he didn't talk to her. He called back and the person heard a gunshot over the phone. Moses has a preliminary hearing scheduled for September 24th at the Bethel Courthouse. Tanunak is located on Nelson Island on the Bering Sea coast. There are about 325 residents there. A second terrible death of a child happened over the weekend in Kotzebue. 5-year-old Jordan Lee Reed was found dead early Sunday in Kotzebue after being mauled by a loose dog or dogs. The boy was reported missing Saturday night. Police said he had been playing in front of his family's home that evening. Kotzebue Mayor Nathan Koch says loose dogs have been an increasing problem in the town of about 3,200 people. He says the city council recently tightened up an existing animal control ordinance. The revised ordinance requires people with dogs on a vicious breeds list to carry insurance for their animals and to keep them securely penned. Alaska Public Safety Commissioner Joe Masters is resigning. Masters has held his current position since 2008. Masters said in his resignation letter that he plans to return to the private sector. His resignation will be effective October 15th. Another company out of Washington just won permission to study the potential development of a new hydroelectric plant at a mountaintop lake within the Petersburg borough. The federal government has awarded a preliminary permit for the Cascade Creek project to Hydro Development LLC. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission issued the permit to Hydro Development LLC on August 29th. It allows that company 3 years to study the potential for a power plant at Swan Lake and Cascade Creek in Thomas Bay on the mainland, about 15 miles northeast of Petersburg. It also puts the company first in line to submit a license application to build the project.
We're just getting started on putting it together, so this will give us the opportunity to go to it.
Hydro Development Chief Executive Corky Smith owns the Olivine Corporation in Bellingham. According to Smith, Olivine mines the mineral of the same name and uses it in the manufacture of high-temperature burners that can convert wood waste to energy. He says that work prompted his interest in hydropower.
We're in the waste-to-energy business and power generation, and I've been wanting to work on these hydro projects for a while, and this one looks like a great opportunity to do something, so I'm happy that we were able to get that permit and we can get started on it.
Smith says he's not yet lined up funding for the project, but says he can move ahead on that work now that he has the permit. He organized Hydro Development as a limited liability corporation in Alaska in February 2012, just a day before submitting the federal permit application. That was just a couple of days after another Bellingham company, Cascade Creek LLC, had been denied a third preliminary permit for the same project. FERC filings are publicly available, and Smith's application language and documentation is nearly identical to Cascade Creek's, with one significant difference. Hydro Development wants to draw down Swan Lake as much as 40 feet to produce electricity. Cascade had proposed to stay within a 6-foot seasonal fluctuation of the lake. Swan Lake is a popular hunting, fishing, and tourism destination on the Tongass National Forest. The original proposal from Cascade Creek prompted extensive objections from many local residents and local government, as well as state and federal resource managers, who raised procedural, technical, and environmental concerns. Barbara Stanley is the Forest Service's Regional Energy Coordinator.
A lot of our concerns about the previous project were due to lack of communication between the applicant and the agencies, a rather poor job of analyzing the environmental effects of the project to the point where it was almost impossible for the agencies to determine what the overall project effects might be.
In denying Cascade Creek a third permit, FERC cited a lack of progress as well as concerns voiced by the resource agencies and local residents. Officials with Hydro Development and Cascade Creek have said their companies are not working together. In a letter last fall, Hydro Development's Corky Smith told FERC that he had no business affiliations with Cascade Creek. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Supporters of a ballot measure that would repeal a controversial labor ordinance passed by the Anchorage Assembly earlier this year have gathered the signatures needed to put the issue before voters. KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports.
Supporters of the ballot measure to repeal the labor law, also known as AO37, say they got more than triple the number of petition signatures needed to get the issue on the ballot. Eric Tuot, vice president of the International Association of Firefighters Local 1264, helped deliver the signatures to City Hall Monday. He says the number of signatures gathered says a lot.
Well, I think that says that people aren't happy with the way that the process worked when the assembly ran through the AO37. And so I think a lot of people are unhappy regardless of what side of the aisle they're on, and they don't want politics like this done in Anchorage, and we think the signatures prove that.
The labor ordinance takes away municipal workers' right to strike and restricts collective bargaining rights. The assembly passed it last March despite protests and with people still waiting to testify on it. The unions had 26 days to collect the 7,124 signatures required to get the initiative on the ballot. They say they gathered more than 22,000 signatures. The city still has time to appeal a court ruling that allowed signature gathering to go ahead. If that happens, the ordinance could be back in court. If the city doesn't appeal, a public vote could either be held in a special election in December or in the regular municipal election in April. The assembly would make that decision. The municipal clerk's office has 10 days to certify or reject the petition. AO 37 would affect more than 2,000 city employees. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska Native Corporations and Alaska Pacific University are teaming up on a program that will foster the next generation of Native leaders in the state. Executives representing seven Alaska Native corporations met this past weekend with APU faculty for the start of the Alaska Native Executive Leadership Program, which has been approved by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. APU's academic dean, Tracy Stewart, says the course is sponsored by five Native entities.
Particularly Afognak Native Corporation, which was really the spearhead behind this. But how this enriches Alaska is we have a commitment as a place for an opportunity for private higher education with access to all of the peoples of Alaska. And we have a specific value to acknowledge and honor the commitment to serve Alaska Native peoples. And so this program, this opportunity and this partnership has enabled us to continue to honor that value.
The program is geared to executives, and the coursework can be applied to APU's MBA program. Those enrolled in the program will undertake a 9-month course of study. Developing the next generation of Alaska Native leaders is among the concerns of corporations that began with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 1971. Siri, Chugach Alaska, Bristol Bay Native Corporation, and the Aleut Corporation are taking part as well.
And the Native corporations in our partnership are major economic engines in the state. So the opportunity to partner with them in this executive leadership development program helps everybody in terms of growth of employment, opportunities for Native and non-Native peoples in continuing to enrich and grow the state that we live in. So it serves our mission, and it's just a marvelous opportunity to be involved in this incredibly important part of Alaska's economy.
The course is open to those nominated by sponsoring corporations, with a few exceptions for those working on an MBA from the university. Stewart says the course will be offered for 3 years. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation is hoping a new challenge will help put an end to the honey bucket in rural Alaska. Over 6,000 homes in the bush don't have running water and sewer service. And the state and federal government can't afford to install expensive centralized systems that are difficult to maintain in those small villages. So the state wants to encourage innovators to form teams to design a new type of system that could work. Bill Griffith with DEC came up with the idea for the challenge.
I guess it became clear to us that we needed to really begin to come up with new ways of providing that service. And we looked around at the technologies that were available off the shelf and being used here in Alaska, and didn't really see anything that would allow us to get service to those homes affordably. But when we looked around the world, we could see that some innovative things were being done, and what we decided was that there might be a way to bring some of those ideas into Alaska, put together existing technologies really in ways that haven't been put together here in the state. So that's what's kind of the beginning of the challenge.
Do you have an idea of what the ideal system would look like?
Well, we have an idea that there may be what we call decentralized systems, which would primarily be household-based, where the primary idea is there may be ways of recycling some of the water for some of the uses in the home. We're still looking at the likelihood that some treated water will need to be brought into the home primarily for drinking and cooking, but that's a relatively small amount of the total water that's used in the home. So there may be other water uses that could come from recycled water. I mean, an obvious example is flushing a toilet. You don't need the same water quality for flushing a toilet as you do for drinking. But there are other ways that people are using recycled water in other parts of the world for things like hand washing, clothes washing, and even bathing. And so we want to take a look at some of those technologies and see whether it might be possible to use them here in Alaska.
Why is it important to get rid of honey buckets?
Well, the most important reason is just that we know that honey buckets and, in general, the lack of running water in a home are directly linked to health problems. And in Alaska specifically, there have been a number of health studies recently that have shown that homes without running water and sewer have much higher rates of skin infections and respiratory infections. And those also affect the young and infants to a much higher degree as well. So these are the kind of specific health problems that are associated with the lack of running water and sewer. And that's the most important reason, is just because of the direct health benefits of having running water in the home.
What kind of response have you had to the challenge so far?
At this point, we've seen a good deal of interest, particularly among Alaska-based companies and institutions, but we're also getting calls from around the country, and it's worth noting that this is actually an international solicitation. So we're hoping to get some interest as well from companies and researchers that may be based outside the country as well.
I did want to ask about that. Do you see that it's possible that what could be developed here could be used in other places in the United States and the world?
Absolutely. There, besides Alaska, we know that there are many thousands of homes across the Arctic that lack running water and sewer. There are homes throughout Russia and places like Mongolia that lack running water and sewer. And beyond that, there are places like remote homes and cabins and different places all over the United States and the world that lack access to either a centralized public water and sewer system or individual systems that you might expect to see, like wells and septic systems, aren't possible for one reason or another. So, yeah, we think the potential is there well beyond Alaska.
Bill Griffith is a manager in the Water Division at the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. To learn more about the Water Sewer Challenge, go to alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer and Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. And by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.